Picture this. You're at 12,500 feet. The sky is clear, the ride is smooth, and you feel great. Better than great. Actually, kind of euphoric. Everything looks fine on the panel. You're not stressed, you're not sweating, you feel like you've got this completely handled, and then someone on the ground who has been watching your GPS track calls you and says your last three radio transmissions were nonsense. That's hypoxia. And the worst part isn't what it does to your body. The worst part is that it tells you everything is fine while it takes away the tools you need to figure out that it isn't. I'm Pattern, and this is Traffic Pattern on Radio Hangar. Today we're going to talk about one of the most dangerous emergencies a pilot can face at altitude, partly because it happens quietly, and partly because the symptoms it causes are the exact same things that make you think you don't have a problem. Before we get into the physiology, quick word from our friends at AviationSoul.com. They make challenge coins for every milestone in the journey. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, commercial. These are the moments that define a flying career, and Aviation Soul makes something you can hold in your hand to mark them. AviationSoul.com. All right, let's start with the basics, because this is one of those topics where the ground school version and the real version are pretty different. Hypoxia means your brain isn't getting enough oxygen, not your lungs. Your brain, your lungs might be working just fine, you might be breathing normally, but as you climb, the percentage of oxygen in the air stays the same at about 21%. While the partial pressure of that oxygen drops, and partial pressure is what actually drives oxygen across the membrane in your lungs and into your bloodstream at sea level. That partial pressure is doing a lot of work. By the time you get to 18,000 feet, it's doing about half as much. And your brain, which uses more oxygen per pound than any other organ in your body, is the first thing to notice. Now, here's where the regulations come in. And it's worth understanding why the numbers are where they are. The Federal Aviation Administration, or FAA, requires supplemental oxygen for the required flight crew at cabin altitudes above 12,500 feet for flights lasting more than 30 minutes. Above 14,000 feet, the crew has to use oxygen continuously, and above 15,000 feet, every passenger has to have it available. These numbers come from research on time of useful consciousness, and time of useful consciousness is one of the most important concepts in high-altitude flying that most student pilots learn once for the written test and then forget about until they need it. Time of useful consciousness is the amount of time between the onset of hypoxia and the point where you can no longer take meaningful action to save yourself. And the numbers are startling. At 15,000 feet, time of useful consciousness is somewhere between 15 minutes and 30 minutes. At 18,000 feet, you're looking at 5 to 15 minutes. At 25,000 feet, it's down to 2 to 3 minutes. At 45,000 feet, where some of the early U2 research was conducted, time of useful consciousness is about 9 to 15 seconds. Now, a student pilot in a Cessna 172 isn't going to 30,000 feet, but the numbers matter at training altitudes too. If you're doing cross countries at 12,500 feet and you've been up there longer than you realized, or you're dealing with a cracked heat exchanger putting exhaust gases into the cabin, you could be significantly affected before you catch it. Let's talk about what the symptoms actually look like, because this is where the real training value lives. There are four types of hypoxia, and the one you're most likely to encounter as a student pilot is hypoxic hypoxia. That's what we've been describing: reduced oxygen, partial pressure at altitude. The other types include hypemic hypoxia, which is what happens when your blood can't carry enough oxygen even if you're breathing normally. Think anemia or carbon monoxide poisoning. Histotoxic hypoxia is when your body can't use the oxygen that's in your blood, which alcohol causes. And stagnant hypoxia is circulation-related, but let's stay with hypoxic for now, because that's the altitude problem. The first symptoms are subtle, and I mean genuinely subtle. Many pilots never notice them until after the fact. Euphoria is one of the most commonly reported early signs you feel good. Alert, confident, like you're flying really well. This is the irony that makes hypoxia so dangerous. The thing that's about to hurt you first makes you feel like you're at the top of your game. Other early signs include an increased breathing rate as your body tries to compensate. A slight headache that feels like it might be the sinuses, a tingling in the fingertips or around the lips. Some pilots report the edges of their vision starting to narrow slightly, though it's subtle enough that you might not catch it yourself. Then comes impaired judgment, and this is where the real danger lives. Here's something I wish someone told me when I was training. Impaired judgment feels like normal judgment from the inside. You cannot tell the difference between thinking clearly and thinking slowly when you're the one whose thinking is affected. This is why hands-on hypoxia training. the kind you can do in an altitude chamber or through a hypoxia recognition training course, is so valuable. It lets you feel your own personal symptoms in a controlled environment so you know what to look for before you're in the actual situation. Everyone has different symptoms at different altitudes. Some people get that tingling first. Some people get the euphoria. Some people get an unexpected emotional reaction, irritability or laughter that doesn't quite fit the moment. Some pilots report their instrument scan starting to slow down before anything else. Your symptoms are personal, and the only way to really know them is to experience them safely on the ground first. The Airman certification standards for the private pilot checkride include hypoxia recognition under the aeromedical factors section, and the examiner is going to want to know your symptoms, the regulatory requirements around supplemental oxygen, and what corrective action to take. Let's walk through this together from the cockpit perspective. You're on a cross country at 12,000 feet. You're legally within the window, but you've been at this altitude for about 40 minutes and you weren't paying close attention to the clock. You notice you're feeling pretty good. Really good, actually. Your radio calls feel smooth. You think you're making great decisions? The correct action, the one the ACS is looking for, is to descend. Get below 10,000 feet, preferably closer to 8,000 or lower if terrain allows. Put on the oxygen mask if you have one available. Check in with ATC if you're in contact and let them know what you're doing. The critical point for both the check ride and real life is that you do not try to troubleshoot hypoxia at altitude. You do not say, "Let me just see how I feel in 5 more minutes." Time is the resource you do not have. You descend first and analyze later. Now I want to spend a few minutes on carbon monoxide because it overlaps with this conversation in a way that matters and sometimes gets treated as a separate topic when it really shouldn't be. Carbon monoxide poisoning causes what we call hypemic hypoxia. The source in light piston aircraft is almost always exhaust gases leaking past a cracked heat exchanger into the cabin heater airflow. You're breathing slightly contaminated air, the carbon monoxide binds to your hemoglobin, and it blocks oxygen from doing its job. The symptoms are similar enough to altitude hypoxia that they're easy to confuse. A headache, especially across the forehead. Unusual fatigue, a slight nausea, sometimes visual disturbances. The correct immediate actions for carbon monoxide are the same as for hypoxia. Turn the cabin heat off, open a fresh air vent, descend to lower altitude, land as soon as practicable. Here's an important difference though, and it's worth drilling into your thinking. Hypoxia from altitude gets better almost immediately when you descend and start breathing higher pressure air. You'll feel the difference in minutes if you caught it in time. Carbon monoxide does not clear quickly. The half-life of carboxyhemoglobin in your blood breathing normal air is 4 to 5 hours. With supplemental oxygen, it comes down faster, but you're still significantly impaired for a long time after you've removed the source. This is why carbon monoxide incidents often require a trip to the hospital, not just a precautionary landing. A carbon monoxide detector is cheap, small, and lives in your airplane. If you don't have one, consider it a reasonable addition to your next preflight inventory. Let me come back to the training angle for a moment. Many student pilots train at sea level or low elevation airports and never think much about altitude physiology because the numbers feel abstract. But if you're planning cross countries toward mountainous terrain, if your route goes through the Rockies or the Sierra Nevada as a private pilot, this is not abstract information. The ACS for the private pilot certificate specifically lists hypoxia, its symptoms and corrective actions as knowledge the applicant must demonstrate. But more than the check ride, this is one of those topics where understanding the why makes the what much easier to remember and actually use. Your brain is a hungry organ. It consumes about 20% of the oxygen your body processes while accounting for only 2% of your body weight. It does not have reserves. When oxygen partial pressure drops, your brain starts slowing down, and the thing doing the slowing is also the thing you would need working at full speed to recognize that it's happening. That's the trap, and it's worth saying out loud. So the practical takeaways here are these: know the regulatory numbers. Cold supplemental oxygen is required for required crew above 12,500 feet for more than 30 minutes. Above 14,000, crew uses it continuously above 15,000. It's available to passengers. These are not suggestions. Plan your altitude with that in mind. If you're flying a piston airplane without supplemental oxygen aboard, there is no good reason to spend extended time above 12,500 feet. It's not illegal at the 30-minute mark, but it's pushing toward a margin that has no upside. Know your personal symptoms if you can. The FAA's Civil Aerospace Medical Institute, also known as CAMI, offers altitude chamber training through regional programs. The AOPA Air Safety Institute has online resources. Some flight schools arrange group sessions. If you've never felt your own hypoxia symptoms in a controlled environment, you're flying with an unknown. That's worth addressing before you need to know. Trust the instruments and the clock over how you feel. If your altitude is where you thought it was, but something seems off, act on what the instruments and regulations tell you, not on your self-assessment. That principle applies to spatial disorientation too, but it's especially important here because hypoxia specifically compromises the part of you that does the self-assessing. And consider a pulse oximeter as part of your cross-country kit. They're inexpensive, they clip onto your finger in about 3 seconds, and they give you an objective read on your blood oxygen saturation without relying on a symptom you might not notice. Know your baseline at sea level so you have something to compare to at altitude. The FAA's Aeronautical Information Manual and the CAMI Aeromedical Literature are both worth reading on this topic. The AOPA Air Safety Institute has a free online course on aeromedical factors that covers hypoxia in real depth. It's worth your evening more at radiohanger.com. I'm Pattern. Know your ceiling and stay ahead of it.